Carly Gregg. The Mississippi Mom Killers Fight for Justice. At just 14 years old, Carly Gregg committed one of the most disturbing crimes Mississippi has ever seen. She walked into her mother's bedroom with a loaded revolver and pulled the trigger twice. Her mother lay dead. Her stepfather barely survived. And Carly? She sat calmly on the couch, texting her friends and petting the family dogs while the body bled upstairs. The trial was swift. The verdict was damning. Life without parole. But now, just 1 year later, Carly Gregg is making headlines again. Not for what she did, but for what her lawyers claim was ignored. They say she was mentally ill, that the system failed to recognize signs of bipolar disorder, depression, and trauma, that critical psychiatric records were buried before the trial, and that this teenager, branded a killer, deserves another chance in front of the law. As the Mississippi Supreme Court prepares to hear her appeal, one question remains. Is Carly Gregg a calculating murderer or a broken child society refused to understand? So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. A Quiet House, a Loaded Gun.
Brandon, Mississippi. March 19, 2024. The sun had barely risen when the quiet neighborhood on Turtle Drive stirred awake, unaware that inside one of its well-kept suburban homes, a brutal act had already reshaped a family forever.
The Gregg house stood like any other on the block, white siding, trimmed hedges, the American flag gently rippling in the breeze. Inside, 14-year-old Carly Madison Gregg walked with calm purpose toward her parents' bedroom. She wasn't sneaking, she wasn't shaking, she wasn't crying. Her mother, 40-year-old Ashley Smiley, a beloved high school teacher and mother of two, was still asleep in the bed she shared with her husband, Heath Smiley. A revolver, 357 Magnum, had been kept under the mattress, hidden from view, supposedly secure.
Carly knew where it was. She'd known for a while.
She reached beneath the mattress and took hold of the cold, heavy steel. With no hesitation, she pulled the trigger.
The first shot rang out like a thunderclap.
Ashley Smiley never stood a chance. The bullet tore through her chest. She gasped, tried to sit up. A second shot followed. The bedroom, once a place of rest and routine, had become a slaughterhouse. Blood soaked the sheets. Carly stood motionless. Then she reached for her phone and sent a message to a friend. The text read, "Are you squeamish around dead bodies?"
Then she sent another to her stepfather, Heath, who was still at work. That one said,
"I need to talk to you. Something happened."
There was no panic, no sign of fear, no attempt to escape. Instead, Carly walked downstairs, calm, controlled. She greeted the family dogs, pet them gently, and then sat on the couch, waiting in silence for what would come next. Heath Smiley was the first to arrive. The door opened. Carly was sitting on the couch. "I need you to come upstairs," she said.
"What happened?" he asked.
"Mom's dead," she answered. "I shot her."
At first, Heath didn't believe her. Then he saw the gun in her lap. He turned and tried to run. A shot rang out. It grazed his shoulder.
Bloodied, stunned, Heath launched forward, wrestling Carly to the ground, managing to wrench the gun from her grasp.
Outside, a neighbor had already called 911 after hearing gunfire. By the time Rankin County Sheriff's deputies arrived, the scene was secure, but what they walked into would haunt them for years. Body cam footage later showed officers entering a strangely quiet home. Carly stood calmly in the hallway.
"Where is she?" one officer asked.
"In the room," Carly said.
They found Ashley Smiley sprawled on the bed, soaked in blood, clearly dead. The officers moved quickly, cuffing Carly without struggle. She didn't scream. She didn't resist. She didn't cry.
At the sheriff's office, Carly was read her rights. An officer asked her if she understood them.
"I guess so," she said.
In early interrogations, Carly said she blacked out, that she didn't remember pulling the trigger, that she was depressed, that something inside her had snapped.
Investigators weren't buying it.
They'd seen the texts. They reviewed her phone history. There was no evidence of rage, no fight with her mother, no diary entries filled with threats or desperation, no signs of abuse.
What they found instead was chilling, a pattern of emotional detachment. No grief, no panic, just clinical recollection. And that eerie text, "Are you squeamish around dead bodies?"
made it feel like a twisted experiment.
The community was stunned. Ashley Smiley had been a teacher at Brandon High School. Her students loved her. Parents praised her. She was known for volunteering at school plays, helping kids with learning disabilities, baking cakes for fundraisers.
Her death hit hard, especially when they learned her daughter had pulled the trigger.
Reporters swarmed the area. National media picked up the story. The phrase, Mississippi Mom Killer, started trending on social media. But beneath the headlines, a more complex picture was emerging.
Carly's defense team, led at the time by a local public defender, began preparing an insanity defense. They claimed Carly suffered from severe mental illness, undiagnosed bipolar disorder, depression, auditory hallucinations, blackouts.
They brought in a psychiatrist who testified that Carly had been harming herself for years and had no memory of the shooting.
The prosecution pushed back hard.
They argued that Carly knew exactly what she was doing, citing her text messages, her calm demeanor, and her efforts to stage the scene afterward. The case, they said, wasn't about mental illness. It was about cold-blooded murder.
As the trial date approached, the courtroom buzzed with anticipation. People wondered, was this a child who snapped or a killer in disguise?
Behind the courtroom doors, Carly sat silent, barely reacting, her hair tied neatly behind her ears. No tears, no emotion.
Ashley Smiley's family filled the rows behind the prosecution. Heath Smiley, still recovering from his gunshot wound, testified through tears.
I raised her, he said. I loved her like my own daughter.
He stared at Carly.
I just don't understand.
By the end of the week, the jury reached its verdict in under 2 hours. Guilty.
On all counts. First-degree murder. Attempted murder. Tampering with evidence. The sentence. Life without the possibility of parole.
Carly Gregg was just 15 years old.
Outside the courthouse, reporters asked if the family had any final words.
Heath Smiley simply said, "We're broken, and there's no fixing this."
But deep inside the legal machinery of Mississippi, a second story was beginning to stir, one that would question whether the justice system had acted too quickly or not carefully enough. Because behind bars, Carly Gregg had just hired a new attorney, and he believed her story wasn't over.
Not by a long shot.
Chapter 2. The Girl Behind the Gun. Before the shooting? Before the mugshot? Before the headlines, Carly Gregg was, by most accounts, an ordinary teenage girl.
She had a TikTok account, a small circle of friends, and a fascination with photography. Teachers described her as quiet, creative, a little moody at times, but nothing alarming.
To most adults, she blended into the background like so many adolescents trying to find themselves in the chaos of high school. But inside Carly's mind, the world wasn't quiet at all. There were voices. Not all the time, but enough to leave her disoriented. There were blackouts, periods of time she couldn't remember, even when she tried. There were sharp bursts of emotion that seemed to come from nowhere, laughter that turned to tears without warning, calmness that dissolved into rage.
She had begun cutting herself around age 12, shallow, calculated slices across her forearm, usually hidden beneath long sleeves. She journaled sometimes, but never shared her entries. She had written about being invisible, about being trapped, about not feeling real. Still, none of it had raised enough concern for serious intervention. School counselors noted her withdrawn behavior, but chalked it up to teen angst. Her parents, Ashley and Heath, were loving, but busy. Ashley taught full-time. Heath worked long hours.
They tried to talk to Carly, but she rarely opened up.
Until the shooting, no one had any idea how far she had slipped.
After her arrest, Carly was taken to a juvenile detention facility. There, in isolation, the full psychological evaluation began. A court-appointed psychiatrist met with her daily. He noted her flat affect, lack of remorse, and the way she spoke about the murder, as if describing a scene from a movie. She didn't flinch when recounting the moment she pulled the trigger. Instead, she spoke in cold, detached fragments.
I went in, she said. She was sleeping. I took the gun. I shot her. She screamed a little. Then I shot again.
When asked why, she paused for several seconds.
I don't know, she finally said. I was tired.
Tired of what?
Just everything.
It was during these sessions that the psychiatrist began piecing together what the defense would later argue was a severe and undiagnosed mental illness. Carly had a family history of depression. She had exhibited signs of bipolar disorder, manic energy followed by crushing emotional lows.
She described hearing voices that weren't there. She said they told her she was worthless, that her mom hated her, that the only way out was violence.
These weren't the confessions of a hardened killer. They were the echoes of a mind collapsing under pressure no one had noticed.
Meanwhile, in Brandon, the town tried to make sense of what had happened.
News outlets ran headlines like, "Killer in the Classroom," and "Teen Slays Teacher Mom." Neighbors were stunned. Former classmates cried during interviews. Ashley Smiley's colleagues held candlelight vigils, calling her a light in every dark room.
The prosecution, led by District Attorney Marcia Delaney, leaned into the narrative that Carly was cold, calculating, and aware. They pointed to her calm behavior after the killing, the bizarre text messages she sent, and the fact that she attempted to shoot her stepfather when he came home.
"This was not an accident. This was not a mental breakdown," Delaney said at a press conference. "This was a deliberate act by someone who knew exactly what she was doing."
The defense team disagreed, but they struggled to be heard over the public's outrage.
One piece of evidence would become central to both sides: the text messages Carly sent in the minutes after the murder.
"Are you squeamish around dead bodies?"
The prosecution saw this as a taunt, a sign of Carly's cruelty. They argued that no mentally ill person would joke about death moments after committing murder.
But the defense saw it differently. They argued the message wasn't a joke. It was a symptom, a disconnection from reality, a teenager trying to make sense of something unspeakable by narrating it like a scene from a film.
Carly had always been obsessed with true crime shows, and the defense believed she was modeling her actions after characters she had watched on screen.
"She wasn't planning a murder," her attorney said. "She was disassociating. She was mimicking behaviors she didn't fully understand."
But in a conservative Mississippi courtroom, the line between mental illness and evil was razor thin.
By the time Carly's trial began in September 2024, she was 15 years old. She wore a white blouse, navy skirt, and a blank expression. Her hair was neatly brushed. Her wrists bore faint scars, barely visible.
The courtroom was packed. Journalists filled the back rows. Ashley Smiley's friends and co-workers wore matching ribbons in her memory. Heath Smiley sat near the front, his arm still partially immobilized from the bullet that grazed him.
Carly rarely looked at anyone.
The trial moved quickly. The prosecution presented a clear timeline: the murder weapon, the 911 calls, the text messages. They called officers, crime scene techs, and Heath to testify.
The jury watched body cam footage showing Carly calmly talking to police as they walked through the bloodstained house. The defense brought in the psychiatrist who had evaluated Carly in custody. He testified about her hallucinations, her self-harm, her history of trauma. He warned the jury that Carly wasn't evil, she was broken. But the prosecution rebutted with their own expert, who testified that Carly met the legal definition of sanity under the M. Magan rule. She knew right from wrong, and that's all the law required.
In the end, it took the jury just under 2 hours.
Guilty. On all counts.
The judge sentenced Carly to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The courtroom went still.
No gasps, no outbursts, just silence.
Even Carly didn't react.
But something unexpected happened a few weeks after the sentencing. Carly's family quietly changed her legal team. In stepped a new name, James Murphy, a defense attorney from Carthage with a reputation for taking on long-shot appeals.
He had read the transcripts. He had watched the trial. And he believed something was wrong.
"I don't care what the public thinks," Murphy told a local news station. "This girl deserves a real appeal, because what happened in that courtroom, it wasn't justice."
He began digging through records, medical evaluations, psychiatric notes, school counselor reports that had never made it into evidence. And what he found would spark a new firestorm, one that would take the battle all the way to Mississippi's highest court.
Chapter 3. The appeal machine starts turning.
James Murphy wasn't a celebrity lawyer. He didn't posture for cameras or chase headlines. But within Mississippi's criminal defense circles, his name carried weight. Known for his relentless commitment to post-conviction justice, Murphy specialized in the cases everyone else had given up on, especially those involving young offenders with complicated psychiatric backgrounds.
When he was approached by a quiet, emotionally shattered relative of Carly Gregg, he didn't say yes right away. He asked for transcripts. He reviewed court documents. He read psychiatric evaluations. He watched the trial footage twice.
What struck him most wasn't Carly's cold demeanor or the grisly nature of the crime. It was what was missing. Critical psychological evidence had never been formally introduced into trial record.
Key mental health documents from the months leading up to the murder had been excluded on procedural grounds. The initial defense team had focused heavily on Carly's behavior after the killing, but Murphy believed the story began much earlier, with Carly's unraveling mental health.
What he saw wasn't just a conviction. He saw a case built too quickly, judged too harshly, and carried out in a courtroom swept up in public outrage.
She didn't stand a chance, Murphy told a colleague. By March 2025, just 6 months after Carly's conviction, James Murphy filed a formal notice with the Mississippi Supreme Court. Carly Madison Gregg would be appealing her life sentence.
The first step in any appeal is straightforward. Review the trial for procedural errors. Murphy didn't need to look far.
Carly's previous defense team had failed to include several pre-indictment medical records. That, Murphy argued, would have supported a more robust insanity defense.
These documents detailed her mental health history from age 12 through the months before the shooting, including therapy notes that referenced suicidal ideation, panic episodes, auditory hallucinations, and a pattern of disassociation.
One particularly disturbing session, recorded 6 months before the murder, had Carly describing herself as floating above her body while watching herself get mean and angry like a monster.
None of that had been seen by the jury.
Murphy filed a motion on April 25, 2025, requesting permission to supplement the appellate record with these documents. The motion stated that the trial court's failure to include them had prevented Carly from receiving a fair trial under Mississippi's mental illness statutes.
He framed the appeal around a single, chilling claim.
This child was not given a voice. Her illness was ignored. The court failed her, and so did we.
But Mississippi's appellate system is built for caution, not speed.
On May 13, 2025, Justice David M. Ishii denied the motion, not on substance, but on timing. Under Rule 10E of the Mississippi Rules of Appellate Procedure, the appellate record must be submitted in full before any supplementation can occur. Murphy had filed too early. It was a procedural setback, but not a defeat.
Murphy quickly filed to preserve his right to resubmit the motion once the full trial transcript was officially accepted into record.
Behind the scenes, he worked tirelessly, preparing for the next round. Oral arguments before the state's highest court.
In the court of public opinion, the shift was more complicated.
To some, Carly Gregg was irredeemable, a teenager old enough to kill, and therefore old enough to face the consequences. Social media threads boiled with anger whenever her name resurfaced. Commenters labeled her the girl with no soul, a future serial killer, or proof that evil starts young.
But others, especially in the legal and psychiatric communities, began to take a second look.
Dr. Elaine Prescott, a forensic psychologist who had testified in over 40 juvenile homicide cases, told a podcast host, "This case was rushed. Diagnosing a 14-year-old as legally sane based on behavior during trauma isn't as cut and dry as the jury believed."
National juvenile justice advocates took note. Organizations like the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth issued quiet statements urging Mississippi to re-examine the use of life sentences for minors, especially those with documented mental illness.
And beneath it all, James Murphy was building momentum, piece by piece.
Inside the Rankin County Detention Center, Carly remained quiet. She was now 16. Her appearance had changed. Shorter hair, pale complexion, dark circles under her eyes. Her days were quiet, controlled. She spoke little, read often.
Therapy was intermittent, but she kept a journal again, something she hadn't done since before the shooting.
Murphy visited once a month. Their sessions were short and mostly focused on legal updates, but sometimes he asked questions unrelated to the case.
"What do you think about when you wake up?" he asked once. Carly stared at the floor.
"I wait to forget," she whispered.
Heath Smiley, Ashley's widowed husband and the man Carly had nearly killed, was less vocal in the media but still adamant in private. He opposed any appeal. In a letter sent to the Supreme Court clerk's office, he wrote, "This wasn't a tragedy. This was murder. And the law got it right."
He refused to speak publicly but monitored the case closely. Friends said he lived with one eye on the news ticker, bracing for a reversal he didn't believe he could survive emotionally.
By June 2025, the case had reached a tipping point. The full appellate record was now officially submitted. James Murphy prepared to refile the motion to include Carly's mental health documents, this time with a corrected timeline and expanded testimony from Carly's previous therapist and psychiatrist.
He knew the court could still deny the motion, that the appeal could stall again, that public opinion might harden even further against him. But for Murphy, it wasn't about winning.
It was about forcing the system to look again. Because when a 14-year-old kills her mother, sits down calmly, and waits for the police, you don't just ask how, you ask why.
Chapter 4. Anatomy of a Broken Defense.
Long before the verdict, even before the arrest, there were signs that Carly Gregg's world was unraveling. But in the courtroom, none of it mattered. The jury didn't see the early warning flags. They didn't hear about the sessions with school counselors. They weren't shown the evidence of a girl spiraling into darkness. And according to James Murphy, that omission wasn't just tragic. It was legally devastating. To understand Carly's appeal, you had to understand what went wrong the first time. Carly's original defense attorney, a court-appointed public defender named Gerald Knowles, had a reputation for competence, but not for challenging high-profile cases. He was juggling six others when Carly's case landed on his desk. With limited funding and a court date moving faster than expected, Knowles opted for a straightforward defense, not guilty by reason of insanity. He brought in a single psychiatrist to testify on Carly's behalf. The psychiatrist described her depression, noted symptoms of bipolar disorder, and introduced evidence of auditory hallucinations. But the testimony was narrow and lacked depth. The prosecutor quickly dismantled it. When pressed, the psychiatrist admitted Carly had never been officially diagnosed with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. She had no prior hospitalizations, no emergency interventions, no formal medication record. And in a conservative Mississippi court, with a grieving family staring down a teenager accused of executing her own mother, those gaps were fatal.
What Knowles didn't do, and what James Murphy now considered unforgivable, was submit the pre-indictment psychiatric documentation that detailed Carly's treatment history before the shooting. These records, compiled by school counselors, pediatricians, and private therapists, painted a drastically different picture of Carly's mental state. 2 years of therapy sessions, referencing suicidal ideation, identity fragmentation, and rage episodes. A family history of bipolar disorder on her biological father's side, never disclosed during trial. Multiple reports of Carly expressing violent fantasies involving herself or someone I live with dying to make it all stop.
One report, dated 3 months before the shooting, contained a chilling quote. "Sometimes I feel like I'm dreaming while I'm awake, like I'm watching myself be bad."
That sentence never reached the jury, and in Murphy's view, that was more than oversight. It was a miscarriage of justice.
Why wasn't the material introduced?
The answer came down to timing and procedural rules.
The records had been submitted late in the discovery process. The trial judge ruled them inadmissible on procedural grounds, citing lack of pretrial notice and chain of custody documentation for third-party files.
Knowles didn't object forcefully. He didn't file a continuance.
He didn't appeal the ruling.
He moved forward, knowing the most compelling evidence of Carly's instability was locked outside the courtroom doors. During cross-examination, the prosecution used that silence like a scalpel.
District Attorney Delaney asked the psychiatrist if Carly had ever been institutionalized.
"No," the doctor answered.
"Had she ever attempted suicide?"
"Not that we have documented," the doctor said.
"Had she been formally diagnosed with any severe psychiatric illness?"
"No."
The jury heard none of the red flags, only the vacuum of official diagnosis. To them, Carly wasn't sick. She was sane and cruel.
James Murphy knew that to win the appeal, he would have to do what Knowles hadn't, establish that the court failed to consider vital psychiatric evidence that could have altered the outcome. He reconstructed the chain of events in a 46-page supplemental motion, which he would file the moment the court allowed additional materials into the appellate record.
He included affidavits from Carly's childhood therapist, a clinical social worker who had worked with the family after Ashley Smiley and Carly's biological father divorced. The therapist wrote,
"Carly displayed deep emotional dissociation from an early age. She was highly intelligent but struggled with grounding herself in reality. Her symptoms were consistent with untreated mood disorder and early onset dissociative tendencies. He also tracked down Carly's pediatrician, who confirmed multiple reports of Carly hearing things and talking to herself, concerns that were documented but never formally pursued due to insurance gaps and limited access to specialized care in their rural district. In short, Carly fell through every crack in the system, and Murphy believed the court needed to see the blueprint of that fall, document by document, affidavit by affidavit, misstep by misstep. Meanwhile, public interest in the case began surging again. National media picked up on the appeal. Podcasts, true crime YouTubers, and legal analysts began dissecting the case. Some were sympathetic, calling Carly a cautionary tale of juvenile neglect. Others were brutal, branding her a manipulator trying to play the mental illness card.
Murphy refused to give interviews, but behind closed doors, he and his small legal team prepared for a legal war of attrition.
"We may not win on sympathy," he told his co-counsel, "but we can win on failure. The court failed to consider essential evidence. That's not emotional, it's constitutional."
Carly's silence, too, became part of the appeal. She had not testified at trial. She barely spoke during sentencing. Some saw that as indifference, but the psychiatric affidavits painted a different reason: extreme emotional dissociation, trauma response, a shutdown, not a cold shoulder.
Her journal, now used as evidence in the appeal, included a haunting entry. "I feel like I'm a shadow that got lost, like I was born in the wrong body. I don't know if I'm real."
In another, she wrote,
"I didn't want her to die. I wanted the voices to stop. I wanted everything to stop."
By the end of June 2025, Murphy had everything ready. His motion to supplement the record was finalized, now meeting all procedural requirements. He scheduled it for submission the moment the appellate court gave the green light. For Carly Gregg, the court's decision on whether or not to admit these documents could mean the difference between life in prison or the start of a new trial,
one that, for the first time, would include her full story.
Chapter 5. Justice or Vengeance.
Inside the marble halls of the Mississippi Supreme Court, the stakes were high, though few outside the legal world seemed to fully understand just how high. To the public, Carly Gregg was a convicted murderer appealing her sentence. To James Murphy, she was a child abandoned by a system that prioritized punishment over truth. And to the court itself, the question was far more complex than guilt or innocence.
It was about procedure, precedent, constitutionality.
Could the state deny a fair trial to a mentally unstable minor simply because of paperwork errors and overlooked psychiatric records? Or had the system done its job by the book, even if the outcome felt brutal?
The justices didn't speak often, but when they did, every word echoed with weight.
The courtroom was smaller than people expected. No camera crews, no dramatic declarations, just the heavy silence of legal gravity.
Murphy stood before the bench, calm but relentless. In front of him sat six black-robed justices, each with a laptop, paper files, and decades of case law memorized. "Your Honors," he began, "this is not a case about excusing murder. This is a case about failing to give a child the protection the Constitution promises her." He explained how Carly's defense had been incomplete, how pre-indictment psychiatric records weren't submitted, how the trial judge denied crucial evidence without hearing full arguments,
how her original attorney failed to object, failed to file motions, failed to preserve Carly's right to a complete defense.
He emphasized the age factor.
She was 14.
14. When she was arrested, she didn't even understand what the term life without parole meant. She didn't know that she would die in a prison cell.
One justice leaned forward. "Counselor, are you asking us to overturn the conviction or the sentence?"
"Both, Your Honor," Murphy replied, "because both were built on incomplete truth."
The Assistant Attorney General representing the state rose next. Her tone was colder, more measured.
"This is not about mistakes. This is about choices. Carly Gregg chose to walk into her mother's room, retrieve a gun, and execute her. She then attempted to kill her stepfather. She showed no signs of panic or confusion. Her texts afterward show calculation, not delusion." She paused, then added, "And the jury, after reviewing all admissible evidence, agreed."
The courtroom remained still. No outbursts, no applause, just the whisper of paper turning.
Outside the legal walls, a different kind of battle was underway. In local coffee shops, church basements, and online message boards,
Mississippians debated the case with the kind of emotional intensity usually reserved for politics or religion.
She knew exactly what she was doing, one Facebook commenter wrote. She should never see daylight again.
Others saw shades of gray.
My niece was diagnosed bipolar at 13, another woman posted. She used to say scary things too, but she got help. What if Carly didn't?
True Crime Podcasts picked up the case again. Some called it a textbook failure of juvenile mental health care. Others dissected Carly's cold demeanor, her lack of tears, her silence in court.
Is she traumatized, one host asked, or is she just stone-cold dangerous?
Heath Smiley, still recovering in body and spirit, submitted another victim impact letter to the Supreme Court. It read,
"She murdered my wife. She destroyed my family. This wasn't some episode of teenage confusion. She knew what she was doing. She waited for me to come home. She tried to kill me too. And now she wants mercy? Where was the mercy for Ashley?"
His words, raw and undiluted, hung heavy in the public record.
But Murphy argued that justice for victims and justice for defendants were not mutually exclusive.
Over the following weeks, court clerks reviewed thousands of pages. Judicial assistants annotated psychiatric timelines, and justices quietly debated a question none of them could avoid.
What is justice when the killer is a child? And
the U.S. Supreme Court had previously ruled that automatic life sentences without parole for juveniles were unconstitutional, but Mississippi courts had found a workaround. By holding many hearings to assess a juvenile's ability to be rehabilitated, Carly's mini hearing had been short, largely unchallenged, and based on evidence Murphy claimed was incomplete.
So now the justices were left with two options.
Uphold the conviction and the sentence, citing procedural legitimacy, send the case back to trial court for reconsideration, potentially reopening the entire case, and the community wounds with it.
Back in her cell, Carly Gregg waited.
Her journal entries during this time grew more introspective, less frantic, less detached.
One entry, dated June 30, read,
"Sometimes I think about her laugh. I think about how I took it away. I don't know how to fix something like that. I don't think you can.
My mother.
If they say no, I'll stay here forever. But I wish they knew I didn't mean for her to die. I just wanted to stop the voices. I didn't want to be the bad one, but I was."
Her mental health had stabilized somewhat with treatment. She now saw a prison psychiatrist weekly, but she remained on suicide watch intermittently, especially around holidays and her mother's birthday.
She never asked for freedom, only for another chance to be heard. By late July 2025, word spread through legal circles that the justices had reached a preliminary decision.
The opinion had not been written yet,
but insiders hinted it was close.
Reporters began camping outside the courthouse again. James Murphy refused to speculate.
"We've said what we needed to say," he told a local station. "Now we wait."
Behind the closed doors of the Mississippi Supreme Court, a vote had been cast. And the next move, whether to bury the case for good or resurrect it for a second trial, would soon send shockwaves through the state.
Chapter 6. The Supreme Court Speaks. It was early August 2025 when the ruling came down. Quiet, clinical, and without ceremony. No televised announcement, no press conference. Just a line of text uploaded to the Mississippi Supreme Court's public docket at 8:41 a.m.
Motion to supplement appellate record. Granted.
And with that, the door reopened. Not fully, but just wide enough for a story the courts had once sealed shut to breathe again.
James Murphy sat in his office when the alert hit his inbox. He stared at the screen for several seconds before exhaling a single word.
Finally.
The ruling was narrow. It didn't overturn Carly Gregg's conviction or sentence, but it allowed Murphy to enter previously excluded psychiatric records into the official appellate record. A critical first step in proving Carly's original trial had been fundamentally flawed. It was a procedural victory, but one that carried deep emotional and legal weight. It meant the justices had acknowledged something was missing from the original case, and in appeals law, that acknowledgement could be the thread that unravels everything.
Within 24 hours, news outlets began covering the decision. Headlines flashed across regional networks.
Carly Gregg appeal gains traction with Supreme Court ruling. New evidence admitted in Mississippi teen murder case.
Justice revisited. The mom killer's second chance.
Some reactions were furious.
Social media threads lit up with rage. Victim advocacy groups issued terse statements condemning the ruling as a betrayal of justice.
One prominent group wrote,
"The court's duty is to protect victims. This ruling empowers murderers with mental illness claims, real or fabricated."
But within Mississippi's legal community, many saw the decision as cautious and reasonable. A state law professor tweeted,
"The court didn't reverse the conviction. It followed due process and allowed the record to reflect the full story. That's not leniency. That's the law doing its job."
Behind prison walls, Carly Gregg learned of the ruling the same day.
The news didn't bring a smile to her face. She didn't jump for joy. According to her prison therapist, she simply nodded and whispered, "Okay."
She had grown quieter over time, more reflective. She now spent hours reading psychology books, journaling, and attending trauma therapy. But her emotional state remained complex. Some days she seemed lucid and remorseful. Other days, distant, lost in thought, unreachable.
In one of her sessions, she told her therapist,
"If they give me another trial, I don't want to lie. I want them to know who I really was, not the robot they saw."
James Murphy wasted no time. Within 10 days of the ruling, he refiled his supplemental brief, now including over 300 pages of psychiatric reports, childhood evaluations, affidavits, and therapy notes. It was, as he described it, the full medical story that should have accompanied the legal one.
The centerpiece of the brief was a chronological breakdown of Carly's mental health trajectory. Age 11, first documented panic attacks linked to bullying at school.
Age 12, self-harm begins. Private journal references, blackouts, and disassociation.
Age 13, school therapist notes auditory hallucinations, family history of bipolar disorder noted in file.
Age 14, month before shooting, Carly writes,
"It feels like something lives inside me. Sometimes I can't hear anything but it."
None of these documents have been presented at trial.
Murphy argued this emotion violated Carly's Sixth Amendment right to a full defense and 14th Amendment right to due process.
The state responded with a firm rebuttal.
In their opposing brief, filed by the Attorney General's office, they claimed, "Carly's mental state did not meet the legal threshold for an insanity defense under Mississippi law."
The documents were late, incomplete, and failed to conclusively prove she didn't understand right from wrong.
Her post-murder behavior, including texting friends and attempting to kill her stepfather, showed clarity of thought, not confusion.
Their brief ended with a pointed line. "Mental illness is not a license to kill. Sympathy should never replace justice." Now, it was up to the Mississippi Supreme Court to decide whether Carly Gregg would receive a new trial.
They had three paths forward.
Uphold the original conviction and sentence, ruling that the new evidence wouldn't have changed the outcome. Remand the case for a new sentencing hearing, allowing for psychiatric reevaluation without retrying guilt. Vacate the conviction entirely and order a full retrial, a decision that would shake the legal system and ignite state-right outrage. But the court gave no timeline. It could be weeks, months. In the meantime, James Murphy turned to advocacy networks. He coordinated interviews with juvenile justice organizations and quietly reached out to trauma specialists willing to testify if a retrial was granted. His strategy had shifted. It was no longer just about Carly. It was about the larger issue of how Mississippi and the country treated mentally ill children in the criminal justice system. In late August 2025, Carly's story reached national television. A major investigative docuseries aired a 90-minute special titled "The Child Who Killed. Was it madness or murder?" The program featured courtroom footage, text message evidence, expert interviews, and newly surfaced audio of Carly speaking in therapy before the murder. In one clip, her voice trembled.
"Sometimes I think I'm someone else, like I leave my body, and she takes over, and I don't come back until it's too late."
The episode trended on social media for 72 hours. Public opinion, once firmly against Carly, began to fracture.
One poll conducted days after the airing showed 44% of respondents now believed Carly should be retried. Another 28% felt she should be resentenced with mental illness taken into account.
It wasn't a majority, but it was no longer a mob.
James Murphy, aware of the shifting narrative, issued a rare public statement.
"We're not asking for forgiveness. We're asking for fairness. Carly Gregg is not a monster. She's a mirror, and what she reflects is the part of our justice system we're most afraid to look at." In a secured wing of Central Mississippi Correctional Facility, Carly sat alone in her cell. The light flickered overhead.
Her journal sat on her lap.
She wrote,
"If they ask me why, I'll tell them everything. The blood, the noise, the not being me. I don't want them to forget my mom, but I don't want to be erased either."
For the first time in over a year, she allowed herself a single thought she had buried since the day she was sentenced.
What if they actually let me go back?
Chapter 7, The Power and Cost of Memory. By September 2025, Carly Gregg had become a symbol, though not everyone agreed on what she represented.
To some, she was a calculated killer manipulating a system, softening on accountability. To others, she was a girl abandoned by the very adults who were supposed to protect her. Somewhere between those extremes was the truth, but truth, especially in the realm of true crime, rarely comes without cost.
For Carly, the cost was memory.
Because now, with the possibility of a new trial creeping closer, she was being asked to revisit every detail. The trauma, the voices, the gun, the blood. And this time, she would have to remember it all out loud.
James Murphy made the request carefully.
"We need to prepare for the possibility of testimony," he said.
Carly was sitting across from him in a sterile prison interview room. Her jumpsuit looked loose on her now thin frame. Her eyes flicked toward the corner of the room where a fly buzzed endlessly against the window pane.
"I don't remember all of it," she said softly.
Murphy leaned in. "You don't have to remember it perfectly. You just have to be honest about what you do remember."
Carly nodded, but her hands trembled in her lap.
"I remember her face," she whispered. "Not what she said. Just her eyes opening when she heard the click."
Murphy didn't speak. He just let the silence sit.
"And I remember the sound. The first shot. Then I couldn't hear anything else."
Tears welled in her eyes, but she didn't let them fall.
"I didn't know how to stop after that."
That same week, the Mississippi Supreme Court issued a scheduling notice. Oral arguments were officially set for November 3rd, 2025. The court would hear final statements regarding whether Carly's conviction should be overturned and whether a new trial should be granted based on the newly admitted psychiatric evidence. Murphy's legal team began rehearsing. They prepared charts, timelines, expert summaries. They reviewed every page of the appellate brief and practiced answers for every likely judicial question.
And they prepared Carly.
In her sessions with her new trauma-informed therapist, Carly began doing something she hadn't done since the trial, speaking about her mother.
"She used to sing in the kitchen," she said one day, "always off-key, but it made the house feel full. Another time, she was tired all the time. I think she loved me, but she didn't know what to do with me. Then one day, without prompting, she said, 'I think part of me thought, if she was gone, I'd be normal. That the part of me that was broken would go with her.' But it didn't. It got louder."
James Murphy knew Carly's words could be risky. Emotional confessions could be misinterpreted as guilt, not trauma. But they also humanized her. They helped explain what so many struggled to understand.
Why would a 14-year-old kill the person who gave her life?
The answer, Murphy believed, was buried in untreated illness, disassociation, and a desperate need for silence in a brain that had never known peace.
To reinforce this point, Murphy arranged for a second expert witness, Dr. Evelyn Travers, a forensic psychiatrist with a national reputation, to conduct an updated evaluation.
Dr. Travers spent 8 hours with Carly across 3 sessions. Her findings were stark.
She concluded Carly exhibited dissociative identity disorder with major depressive features, likely stemming from a mix of early childhood trauma, emotional neglect, and undiagnosed bipolar symptoms.
In her report, Dr. Travers wrote,
"Carly did not commit murder with full cognitive control. She was experiencing a dissociative episode at the time of the crime. Her consciousness was fragmented. Her perception of reality was impaired.
She qualifies for a revised diagnosis and should be reconsidered within a medical legal framework, not a punitive one."
Murphy filed the evaluation with the court as part of the final pre-hearing submission. Meanwhile, Heath Smiley, still carrying the scars, emotional and physical, spoke publicly for the first time in nearly a year.
"In an exclusive interview with the Jackson Clarion Ledger," he said,
"I've spent every day trying to forgive her. I really have, but she tried to kill me, and she killed Ashley. That's not mental illness, that's choice."
When asked about the new evidence, he added,
"The system gave her a fair trial. Now it's giving her more than she gave us."
The public reaction was mixed.
Petitions circulated online, some demanding a retrial, others urging the court to uphold the original sentence. Hashtags began trending again.
Hashtag justice for Ashley. Hashtag try Carly again. Hashtag mental illness is not murder. Hashtag protect victims' rights.
Carly Gregg had become more than a person. She was a mirror reflecting the cracks in the nation's understanding of juvenile crime, mental health, and justice. And on November 3rd, those cracks would be tested in the harsh light of the Mississippi Supreme Court.
On the night before the hearing, Murphy received a handwritten letter slid under his office door. It was from Carly.
The note read,
"If they give me another trial, I'll tell them the truth. I don't want people to think she didn't matter. I just want them to understand that I didn't know who I was. I still don't, but I want to try."
Back in her cell, Carly sat cross-legged on her cot, staring at the wall. No dreams, no plans. Just the echo of her mother's off-key humming and the question that haunted her every day. What if I had asked for help? Would she still be alive?
Chapter 8. The Hearing. On November 3rd, 2025, the Mississippi Supreme Court convened under a cold gray sky. Inside the courthouse, where every door groaned like it remembered every case before it, the gallery slowly filled. Lawyers, journalists, students, victim advocates, and a few out-of-town observers who had followed the Carly Gregg case from the start. The buzz was low and tense. No cameras were allowed, no phones, just notepads, pens, and the haunting knowledge that what would unfold in the next few hours might redefine the boundaries between justice and mercy. James Murphy stood outside the chambers for a moment, adjusting his tie, shoulders tight with resolve. His client wasn't there. Carly, by state protocol, remained inside Central Mississippi Correctional Facility, watching a silent video feed in a cold room with two guards. But her words, her thoughts, her mind, those would be at the center of everything.
At precisely 10 a.m., the gavel fell.
"All rise," the bailiff said, voice echoing.
The seven justices filed in. Their expressions were unreadable, stone-carved masks shaped by decades of seeing the worst of humanity dressed up in arguments and motions.
Murphy began.
"May it please the court," he said, voice calm, steady. "This is a case about absence, not of evidence, but of understanding." He moved with care, recounting how Carly's original trial lacked critical psychiatric records, how those records now showed a consistent history of disassociation, suicidal ideation, and delusional thinking. He cited expert reports, journal entries, therapy notes, and the constitutional precedent for reconsidering juvenile sentencing in the presence of evolving psychiatric science.
Then he paused.
"Carly Gregg is not innocent," he said. "We know what she did. The facts are not in dispute. But facts without context are not justice. And justice without truth is simply punishment."
He gestured to the stack of files behind him.
"These are not excuses. They are explanations. They are the pieces of a young girl's mind that were left out of the courtroom that condemned her to die in a prison cell."
He closed with a plea.
"We ask this court to return this case. Not to erase what happened, but to allow the full truth to be heard. Because if this system cannot distinguish between a monster and a broken child, then what are we even doing here?"
The state responded next. The Assistant Attorney General was direct and unflinching.
"Your Honors, the issue is not whether Miss Gregg had mental health challenges, it's whether those challenges absolved her of responsibility. And the answer, according to a jury of her peers, was no."
She pointed to Carly's behavior after the shooting. Text messages, her calm demeanor, her lack of visible remorse. She questioned the legitimacy of diagnoses made post-conviction. She warned against setting a precedent where any murderer could cry mental illness years after sentencing.
"This court cannot afford to base its decisions on sympathy or hindsight," she said. "The law demands clarity, and the law was followed."
Her voice never wavered.
The justices asked few questions, more than silence, but far less than drama. One justice pressed Murphy on whether Carly could be rehabilitated. Another asked about the timeline of the suppressed documents.
A third asked about the potential trauma caused to surviving victims if a retrial was granted.
Murphy responded with precision.
"She has changed. Not entirely, but meaningfully. She has insight now that she didn't have at 14. And more importantly, she is now being treated for conditions no one believed existed, because they weren't looking."
Meanwhile, in the prison's secure room, Carly sat in a metal chair, eyes locked on the monitor.
She watched James speak. She watched the state argue against her. She watched her future get debated like a policy issue, not a life.
No one spoke to her. No one asked her how she felt.
When the feed cut out, the guard said nothing. Just stood, waiting for her to move.
Carly didn't.
She sat there, hands folded, repeating one sentence in her mind, like a prayer she no longer believed.
She didn't deserve it, but I didn't understand it.
Back at the courthouse, oral arguments closed just before noon. The Chief Justice thanked both sides. Then the bench rose, robes brushing wood, and exited behind the curtain. The room exhaled.
Murphy packed his files slowly, his hands deliberate. He felt no victory, no defeat, just the weight of having said everything that could be said.
Outside, reporters descended, but he declined interviews.
"We wait," he said. "That's all we can do now."
The court would issue its decision within 60 days, possibly sooner. And when it did, it would change lives either way.
If they ruled in Carly's favor, the case would return to trial court for reconsideration, possibly a full retrial.
If they denied the appeal, the case would be closed for good, and Carly Gregg would live the rest of her life behind prison walls.
Back in her cell that night, Carly sat by the small metal table, her journal open in front of her. She had drawn a house, a bedroom, a woman with her eyes closed.
Below it, she wrote, "I am not asking to be free. I am asking to be seen."
The hallway light flickered. She closed the book.
Then she whispered into the dark,
"I miss you, Mom, even if you can't hear it."
Chapter 9. The Decision.
The ruling came on a cold December morning.
No announcement, no warning, just a file uploaded to the Mississippi Supreme Court's website at 7:19 a.m. CST. The title was clinical, "Gregg v. State of Mississippi, Final Opinion." But its contents sent a shockwave through every courtroom, every newsroom, and every kitchen table where Carly Gregg's name had ever been whispered. Quote, "The conviction would stand, the sentence would not." Carly Gregg's appeal had succeeded, partially. The court ruled that while her guilt in the murder of Ashley Smiley was firmly supported by the record, the trial had failed to fully consider her mental health in determining the sentence. By ignoring key psychiatric evaluations, denying vital records, and relying on incomplete testimony, the court had violated Carly's constitutional right to a fair and individualized sentencing process under both state and federal law.
The justices voted 5-2. The life sentence without parole was vacated.
The case was remanded to Rankin County Circuit Court for resentencing, this time with full psychiatric context, expert testimony, and public scrutiny.
Carly Gregg would not walk free, but she would be heard, and that, to many, felt like a second trial.
James Murphy read the ruling alone in his office. Then, for the first time in the entire case, he allowed himself a single, exhausted smile.
Not because he had won, because Carly had finally been seen. In the hours after the decision, the state of Mississippi braced for reaction.
Victim advocacy groups condemned the ruling.
"This is a slap in the face to the victims and their families," one representative said on air. "Life without parole was the only just sentence. Anything less diminishes Ashley's life."
Local talk radio hosts called it judicial activism. Conservative columnists accused the court of being soft on teen killers. National outlets lit up with headlines.
"Mississippi mom killer wins sentencing appeal. Justice or loophole? Carly Gregg to be resentenced. Mental health and murder. Are the courts changing?"
The backlash was swift, but so was the support.
Mental health organizations applauded the decision as progress. Youth justice reform advocates called it a landmark moment in Mississippi's treatment of mentally ill juveniles. Some legal experts predicted the ruling would set precedent for other states reevaluating life sentences for minors.
But in Brandon, Mississippi, the divide remained sharp.
Heath Smiley, the surviving victim, and Ashley's widowed husband issued a public statement. "This ruling doesn't feel like justice. It feels like a loophole. I watched my wife die. I nearly died myself. That child tried to kill both of us. And now she gets another chance? What chance did Ashley get?"
He declined interviews. He stopped returning calls.
Inside Central Mississippi Correctional Facility, Carly was called into the warden's office.
A counselor read her the decision slowly, carefully, watching her face for any reaction.
She blinked once, twice, then asked,
"What happens now?"
The counselor replied, "You're getting a new sentencing hearing. You'll be transported. You'll testify. You'll be evaluated again."
Carly nodded. "Okay." Later that night, she wrote in her journal,
"I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. I'm still here. I'm still her daughter. I still killed her. But now, maybe I can say why."
The resentencing was scheduled for early spring, but the groundwork began immediately. James Murphy filed motions to introduce updated psychiatric reports, new testimony from Dr. Travers, and multiple letters from trauma specialists advocating for leniency. He didn't ask for immediate release. He didn't even ask for parole eligibility within a decade.
He asked for humanity.
"A sentence that recognizes what she did," he wrote, "but also who she was when she did it and what she could become with proper treatment."
And Carly?
She prepared too.
In therapy, she practiced speaking out loud about the killing. Not just the facts, but the emotions.
She cried for the first time in front of a therapist. She asked to read her mother's old school yearbook. She asked to hear her voice, recordings found on old family voicemail messages.
Her therapist allowed it.
Carly listened silently.
When it ended, she said,
"I still can't forgive myself, but I think I can explain myself now." On the eve of the resentencing hearing, James Murphy visited Carly one last time before court.
He brought a plain yellow folder. Inside were letters, dozens of them.
Some were angry, some were kind, some were complicated.
But they were all written to her.
Some from classmates, some from total strangers.
One read,
"I lost my sister to suicide. She never killed anyone, but she heard voices too. I don't excuse you, but I understand you."
Another,
"You ruined lives. You should never be free. But I hope someone teaches you how to live with what you did."
Carly read them all. Then she folded her hands.
"What should I say tomorrow?" she asked.
Murphy thought for a moment.
"Tell the truth," he said. "Whatever it is."
The courtroom was full.
Ashley Smiley's family sat together in silence. Reporters scribbled notes.
The judge entered. The resentencing began.
And Carly Gregg, the Mississippi Nom killer, now 17 years old, stood before the court and spoke for the first time.
"I don't want to be forgiven. I don't expect it. I just want you to know that I remember. I remember her eyes. I remember her blood. I remember what I took. And I'm not asking to leave this place. I'm asking to not be forgotten as a person. I'm asking you to remember that I was sick,
that I needed help, and that no one gave it to me in time. I will live with this forever. I already do." Then she sat down, and for the first time since the shooting, the courtroom was truly quiet.
Chapter 10. A Sentence Redefined.
The resentencing hearing stretched across two emotionally charged days. On one side of the courtroom stood the Smiley family, worn, grieving, and unmoved. On the other stood James Murphy, bolstered by psychiatric experts, legal precedent, and a quiet girl with trembling hands and years of unspoken torment carved into her soul.
The air inside the Rankin County Courthouse felt like glass, fragile, sharp, ready to shatter at any moment.
The judge, Honorable Cassandra Boynton, had read every page of the supplemental files. She had listened to both sides. She had seen Carly Gregg speak for herself, not with defiance, but with exhaustion, not with excuses, but clarity.
And now she would speak. The gallery held its breath.
"I reviewed the trial record," the judge began. "The new psychiatric evidence, the constitutional implications, and the testimony of the defendant."
She looked down at her notes, then directly at Carly.
"This court does not doubt that what you did was horrifying, calculated, and life-altering for everyone in this room. But the law, especially as it pertains to juvenile sentencing, is evolving. And you, Carly Gregg, were a child when you committed this act. A child in crisis. A child unwell."
She paused.
"That does not erase what you did, but it informs what this court must do now."
She folded her hands.
"This court hereby sentences you to 40 years in the custody of the Mississippi Department of Corrections, with eligibility for parole after 25 years.
A gasp rippled through the courtroom. 40 years, not life, and the possibility of parole decades from now.
Ashley Smiley's family sat frozen. Heath Smiley looked down, jaw locked. Reporters scribbled furiously. Carly blinked once, then again,
then dropped their head into her hands and wept, silently.
Not because she was free,
but because, for the first time, she wasn't erased.
Outside the courthouse, reactions were swift and divided.
Some praised the sentence as a balanced compromise.
She won't be walking out tomorrow, one legal analyst said, but she won't die behind bars either, and that's the difference between justice and vengeance.
Others were outraged.
How do you kill your own mother and still get a second chance? A local radio caller shouted. I'll never understand this state.
James Murphy held no press conference. He simply walked Carly's family to their car, shook hands, and disappeared into the crowd.
Carly was transported back to prison the same day, quietly, without spectacle.
But something inside her had changed.
The bars were still there. The cell was the same, but the weight pressing on her chest had shifted.
In a new therapy session the following week, she asked a question she'd never asked before.
Do you think I'll ever be able to do something good? Not for forgiveness, just something that matters?
The therapist looked at her.
I think the fact you're asking is the start.
Back in her cell, Carly picked up her journal and began a new entry. I am not the girl I was at 14. I am not the monster they said I was. I'm something in between. Maybe someone who can still become. I don't want to be a headline. I want to be better. This time, I'll be awake.
She paused, then added one final sentence.
I still miss her every day, but I'm trying to make her proud. And so ends the story of Carly Gregg. Not with a release, not with an execution, but with something far more difficult.
A second chance. Not guaranteed. Not celebrated, but possible.